here we go.
Welcome back to Here We Go with Todd McComas, everyone. So happy to have you here with me again. Little business up front. I am going to be at Kansas City, the Kansas City Improv, January 29th and the 30th. That's two shows each night. If you live anywhere within a reasonable driving distance, which I have to drive like 8 hours there. So I would say I'm going to put it at 6 hours. If you live anywhere within 6 hours of the Kansas City Improv, just go ahead and go to toddcomedy.com. Go to the calendar, hit the event details button under that show. When it pops up those details, it'll say buy tickets. Hit that buy ticket link and it'll take you right to where you need to go to get tickets for either Friday or Saturday, either late show or early show, whichever you prefer. And we'll have a blast. I had a blast last time I was there. The people of Kansas City are so much fucking fun. I can't stand it. So, and it's a good year for them. You know, the Chiefs in contention once again. Last time I was there, the Chiefs won the Super Bowl. Now, again, I'm not saying I had anything to do with that. What I am saying, if you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, why fucking chance it? Do what we did last year. Come pack that place out and we'll have a good ass time and the Chiefs will win the Super Bowl. Repeat. That's what I'm saying. All right, enough of that. Let's talk about this week's episode. Another great friend of mine, a guy that I befriended right away when I first started stand-up comedy, and we had a complete blast for a couple, 3 years there, and then he moved to L.A. to better himself, to further his comedy career. And he has done some fantastic things outside of stand-up comedy since being there. He's made two movies himself, two independent films, and he has written a book. I mean, all kinds of stuff. He has a podcast out right now, the Speakerphone, with my other buddy, Ryan Ian Brewer. So he has a lot of things going on. I kind of think of him as a little bit of a renaissance man. He never stops moving. He's never satisfied creatively, and I love that because, as you well know, I wear a lot of hats myself. I'm kind of that way myself. So I can't wait for you guys to learn a little bit more than you did before about my friend, Michael Malone. So here we go.
Here we go. Here we go.
Michael Malone, my brother, it's so good to be sitting down and chatting with you. It's been forever.
It's been a long, long time.
Without the occasional me calling you to pick your brain about tech and social media stuff, I mean, we've not had a heart-to-heart sit-down in years.
No, it's been a long time. It's been a very, very long time.
You moved to L.A. 9 years ago?
Yeah, about 9 years ago, yeah.
Okay. So it all started in Ohio. That's where you grew up, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So when I met you, when I first started comedy, you were a big guy in the Indianapolis scene. Like you were one of the top headliners for sure. And there was a good mix of you guys running around at that point.
Yeah, there was a lot of strong comics at that time. I mean, Eric was really running a great club there at Morty's, and they were just developing guys left and fucking right.
Yeah, it was great. And it's different now. It's different. It's like a lot of you guys moved away and you were doing your own thing and more industry type cities. And it's there's not many working headliners hanging around. And I feel bad for the young comedians now, because then, man, I feel like my track to comedy was easy. I was like, all you got to do is make friends with like 20 awesome headliners in your first couple months. And then, you know, you get good really quick. So,
and it was a time where like everything was booming too. So there, everybody, not only did you have all these headliners hanging out and, you know, in the scene, but everybody had their own show on a certain night. So you know, you'd have, you know, a Wednesday night at Morty's, you'd have a Thursday at a bar show, you'd have a Monday open mic that somebody was running, like all of the, so you're getting up four or five times a week. And when you're starting out, that's fucking huge, man. That goes such a long way.
Oh, it does for sure. And listen, I don't want to box you in as a stand-up comedian. People listening, you get it. Michael Malone's fucking hilarious. Go see him live when he comes to you, because it's always just, I mean, he just burns the roof down like very few people.
I appreciate that.
So it's awesome to watch, awesome to see always. And I learned a lot from you watching you. You were part of, when I watched you, I was like, okay, this is where good writing meets physical comedy. You remember me when I first started. I was just a robot, just stuck there. I'm just going to rely on these beautiful words.
Well, I think we all are. Yeah. You're just reciting whatever, you know, when I first started, that was all I was doing, was just reciting what I had written down at work or whatever. And then, you know, you're going up in an open mic. So you're literally word for word, you know, thinking that it had to be that way or else it wouldn't work.
Yeah. And I took an improv class early on that you did at Morty's Comedy Joint. And it changed my performance a lot, because now it was like, oh, okay, when I say this line that my mom said in the story, it would help if I kind of acted and sounded like my mom a little bit and sold it. And it changes everything.
Yeah, improv changed my life. I had no desire to do it at all. I didn't think I had that gear in me. And what I tell all the comics that come to me that, you know, for advice, you know, they're starting out, they say, well, what should I be doing? And even if you don't want to do improv, even if you have no interest in doing it, take a class, because what it does is improv opens up, that safety net from you, right? Because it's, you know, stand-up's all about punchlines. It's all about delivering, right? Boom, 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 boom. Where improv is more about listening. And that's what's going to make you a better comic in the long run. That's where you hone those skills of really listening to an audience so you can feel them out, so you know where you can go next. And because once you start doing stand-up for a long time, you have all your jokes on this weird like mental Rolodex, right?
Right.
And you can just kind of pull them at will once you've been doing it long enough. And what improv does is allows you to have the freedom. It takes away that safety net, that robotic, this has to go this way. Now what you're doing is you're listening to the room and you're going, okay, they like dick jokes? Great. Boom. I'm going to pull these out. Oh, they want to hear about my family? Great. I got these over here we can do. And it really allows you to listen. And it also takes away that fear of failure, because stand-up, it's just you up there, right? And all the pressure's on you, and you have to deliver 100% of the time. Where improv, it takes away that fear of failure because you're relying on others. And the whole idea of improv is building, right, to this climax. And so you're building, they're building, and you're building this story together, and then there's a big payoff. And the crowd loves it because they gave you the punchline already, and that takes the pressure of failure away from you because you already have the end to the joke. You just have to get there. And so improv helps so many ways in stand-up that I don't think a lot of people realize.
No, I don't think they do. And I wouldn't have guessed. I just knew I was, to be honest, I just showed up because I'm like, oh, Michael Malone's teaching the class. I should go. I need to learn, and it's a good guy to learn from. But once I got in it, I was like, no, I see like this. And then I really noticed it immediately afterward. It elevates your stand up so much. And not that it instantly made me, you know, somebody that could headline or anything, but it changed it dramatically. Now, beyond your stand up, and hopefully that comes back soon for all of us. But
yeah.
You've done so much since you moved away from Indianapolis. You wrote a book most recently, which I want to talk about.
Yeah, the book Dead Serious. It was something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. I had always wanted to write, and I think that's that's a common fear with stand-ups and performers is you're writing, but you're writing for yourself, right? And you think like, well, this will work now in the moment, right, on stage. But my fear was that if I were to actually sit down and write something down and show it to somebody, then it wouldn't work, or it wouldn't translate, or it just wouldn't be worth it. But I've always been a very personal person on stage. I don't, you know, none of my stand-up has been like, what are the Kardashians up to this week? You know, waka waka. It's all been very personal stories about my family and my experiences and stuff like that. And so that's kind of what I put into the book. I had done my stand-up special, Laugh After Death, and the closing 20 minutes is all about losing my parents a few years ago and going to therapy for the first time and self-care for the first time and touring while grieving and all of these things that I was feeling. And the connection from that I was getting from the audience was something that I'd never felt before. It was a whole new level of connection with an audience, and the conversations that it was generating after my shows, people sharing their stories with me, you know, saying, we just lost my father, we just lost my sister, this and that. And it was really connecting me, and I felt like I had a lot more to say about that. And so when I started thinking about the book, I thought, well, why not share, you know, all the stuff that I've learned since losing my parents when it comes to the therapy and the self-care and, you know, all these other stuff. And it's, so I started writing about that. And, but in a weird way, it's a non-traditional book. It's not just a front to back, like here's story after story. What I did was I broke it up in between stories with jokes. So there's like these illustrated one-liners in there. There's a little bit of self-care tips and tricks in there. And then you have 10 big stories throughout the book, all about my family or this or that. And
now are these, so
it's a really unique book.
These jokes that kind of segue or transition from one part of the book to the other, are they a summation comedically of what I just read, or
no, not at all. Okay. So they're all separate. And so I kind of designed the book where you can open and read it at any point. The stories don't go in any order. The jokes aren't correlated to the stories or anything like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's almost like I would say it's like a David Sedaris book mixed with a Far Side. You put those two together and you'll have my book dead serious.
Well, that's great. Well, I don't want to give up too much away about the book, but I do want to talk to you, if you don't mind, about this period of your life, because I know that it changed you dramatically, changed you forever. And not only as a performer, and as a human being, I'm sure. And I'm sad that I kind of missed that interpersonal friendship that we had during that time, because you were away. But when it first happened, it started with your mother. Is that correct?
No, my stepfather.
Oh, your stepfather. Okay. So how long ago was that?
Man, 6 years ago. It was 2014-ish. Yeah.
Okay, and you say stepfather, but this is the man who raised you.
Yeah, yeah. Wayne was more like my dad than my real dad was, and I lost my real dad when I was 12, and you know, I've had this life of tragedy. I talk about it in the special and in the book, where I've been to over a dozen funerals in the past 5 years, and only one wedding. So I've lost a lot of people, and I've grieved a lot, and. My real father, I really didn't know that well. I joke about him, you know, he was on everything but the right path. And I talk about him in the book. He was such a good dad. He had two families. And so I really didn't get to know him. And then he passed away when I was 12. And then Wayne came around when I was about 14, 15, right around that era. So I was already kind of grown, and had already been my mom and I on our own pretty much my whole life. And my mom and my grandma raised me. And then Wayne came into the picture, and he was such a savior. You know what I mean? Like, he was there for me. He taught me everything. He treated me like his own. So it was like losing a father when he passed.
What an interesting thing that there are these people almost like angels, it seems like, not to make it religious, but like they enter your lives at the right moment. Now you were 14 or 15, you know, you're on your way to becoming a man, but you had lacked a solid father figure before that. And then that's a pivotal age of shaping you as to what kind of man you're going to be. And here comes someone to step in and kind of fulfill that role for you. I mean, how did you feel? Were you right away like, oh my gosh, you know, this is awesome? Or were you hesitant at first? Well, like who the hell are you?
Because you're a kid. You don't fucking know any better. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, ah, this guy's living at the house. All right.
Yeah, I can eat my cereal. What the fuck? Right.
But I will say this, watching, you know, looking back, everything is always looking back, right? When you get older, you start seeing all this stuff because it comes around full circle. And looking back, he taught me so much about relationships. So more than father and son, it was more about the love that him and my mom had. He treated her so well, and you know, they would go on these little weekend getaways, and he, you know, talked about her all the time to his friends and always bragging about me and this and that. Seeing the love and appreciation that he had for my mother, man, was huge, because, you know, that wasn't what you see on TV and movies, or even with your, you know, childhood buddies. You know, they're all talking about their parents getting divorced or how they don't fucking get along, or they're yelling at each other and this and that. And it was the opposite of my household. It was full of love and joy. And like, Wayne was always joking around. He was always just like pure happiness. You know what I mean? Like, he was, his big thing was, he would, he would tell you a joke as if it was real. Right. That was his stepdad move, when he would come in and be like, you hear about that man who bought a kangaroo? And you're like, no, what happened? And he'd be like, oh yeah, you know, guy bought a kangaroo in Cincinnati. And then he'd tell you the story like it's a fucking news story. And at the end, it'd be some stupid dad joke. And you're like, but that was Wayne's go-to. Like, that was his favorite thing to do, was to come at you and be like, hey, did you hear about this?
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Well, that had to bring a sense of peace and one less thing to worry about too, to see your mom have the security of this guy. Like, I don't have to worry about that now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the thing. They were so in love, so in love. And ultimately, not to like get too dark so soon, but, I think after Wayne passed, I think it really took a toll on my mother. You know, you hear people die of heartbreak all the time. And my mother passed within a year of Wayne passing. And I think a lot of it had to do with that. I think a lot of it was heartbreak.
It's not an uncommon thing at all. I mean, you almost can, and I believe this 100%, you almost can will yourself to death. I mean, you can give up, and it will happen very quickly. You see that with people that you know, were workaholics and loved their career and invested their entire existence into their career, and then they are forced to retire and die within a year. You know, same thing. And it's, you know, what a tragedy for you to lose both parents within a year. And then I'm trying to put it in relation to your move to LA and trying to further your career. How early on was that?
It was a few years after that. So, and that was kind of the, you know, the gift and curse of it all is, you know, my parents were very supportive and all that stuff, but that also meant, you know, I'm a workhorse. And so I was doing 46 to 48 weeks a year on the road. And so even when I was living in Indiana and I was still pretty close to them, I didn't get to see them a whole lot. And then when I made the move out west, it was even harder. But I always made it a point to come home for Christmas. And that was my mother's holiday, right? Right. So I would always come home for that and see them and stay for a few weeks. And then after Wayne passed, I made a special point to be with my mom, even like on Wayne's birthday weekend, I would come and spend it with my mother. If I was doing any shows within like a 5-hour radius, I'd fly in and grab my mom up, and then we would go, and she'd actually come on tour with me. You know, her birthday, their anniversary, I spent with her, Christmas, of course, stuff like that. So like, I made sure that I was there for her when I could be, while trying to still balance, you know, when she passed, it was right at the beginning of things starting to happen. So I was starting to get into film and television and stuff like that. Those opportunities were starting to happen. So that was kind of the balance that I was struggling with more so than stand up, was like, you know, trying to juggle those opportunities that I've been fighting for a decade.
Yeah. Yeah. What parts of yourself do you see that directly come from your mom? Like, for instance, like for me, I want everyone to eat all the time. Like, my mom just loves feeding people, and I have that. Like, if you come to my house, I'm going to force a sandwich on you, or let me, hey, I can make this pasta. That's really, I love to cook, and I love to cook and feed people and host that. Am I like, I get that 100% from my mom. What things do you see in yourself that maybe you catch yourself, you're like, oh, that was a piece of my mom right there?
Oh man, all the time. And it's such a, you know, getting into the self-care aspect of it. You know, you'll catch yourself doing something that I don't like. You know, let's talk about that first.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
My mother was such a worrier. And so I'll find myself worrying about something or doing, you know, or, you know, things like that. And I'll have to stop and remind myself that, like, you are not your mother. and in self-care, you have to kind of battle this identity of who you are all the time, right? You're asking yourself that all the time as you're developing and learning new things. And so that is a thing that I have to do a lot, where I'm like, just stop. You're not your mother. You are you. This is we can do this, you know, like, we're not scared of this. It's going to be fine, or, you know, stuff like that. And my mother was a gossip, and I fucking, man, I nothing more I loved than the fucking just catch up on some good gossip. It is so terrible. But yeah, but also on the other side, the good things that she has taught me is joy. Right. My mother was always joking. We would do this thing where, like, growing up, like I said, it was just her and I pretty much. And so I would make her laugh so much until she would pee her pants. And even then, she would like be running through the house like, I'm going to pee. And I'd still be chasing her through the house, like making funny faces and doing things and, like, you know, doing different voices and this and that. And those are the things that I like doing, is making people laugh, making people have fun, you know, teasing people in a good way like that. And my mother loved to cook, and so I'm getting into more of that. And, you know, again, like, looking back, you find yourself going, man, I wish I would have spent more time in the kitchen with my mother and more time in the garage with Wayne.
Sure.
You know, to find those balances. Those were the two spots that you could always find. And my mother was always baking something or cooking something, and Wayne was always cutting something out of wood or painting something or doing right. whatever. And now I wish I would have spent more time doing those instead of, you know, fucking playing sure. Nintendo or whatever.
Well, there's not a kid alive who doesn't wish that they would have done more of those things with their parents. And if that's not the case, then their parents were like, I wish this motherfucker would move out at some point, you know, like,
right.
It's an interesting battle. We're all that way. So I think the same thing. My parents are getting older. My dad's got some shit going on, and I think I should have just done more, but, you know, they think the same thing about their parents, you know. It's just, you go live your life. And as a parent, I know, like, I don't see my son much, right? And we live 5 minutes from each other, and I hardly ever see him. But all I ever wanted in the world was for him to be successful and have his own thing in life that he's really good at and he's really, really enjoys doing. And he's doing it. So I'm like, what am I bitching about? That's all I ever prayed for at night, you know?
Yeah. And that's the way my mom was, even though, you know, I was gone all the time, and I, you know, we didn't get to spend a lot of time together. You know, as I got older, she was still so happy and so proud that I had found this thing and that I was doing well at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're a very busy guy with comedy, because you tour a lot, and obviously you're someone who people enjoy having at their venue and the crowd like to return and see you every year. So that keeps you as, you know, a busy working comedian. But then you were like, well, that's not enough. I have these other creative things that these monsters within me I need to feed. And one of which was to be a film director, to make movies. And you were like, fuck, I'm just going to do it on my own. And I always admired you for that. Every since the first, because you've done two, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the first one, Bethlehem. I'm so proud of you because now I look back, like I'm making a documentary right now, just on my own the same way. And I'm having to fund it myself and all that stuff. And now I look back, I always think, I think of you often during it. Cause I'm like, you know, fucking Michael, remember when he just went down to like Evansville, Indiana and shot this fucking movie and put it out? Like it was good. And it was, you wouldn't have known it was just some comedian out with friends making this themselves. Like you really wouldn't. So talk to me about how that idea first came to be and how you put it to paper or from paper to film.
I fell in love with filmmaking actually on the set of Chopping Block. I was in this comedy horror film. It actually took place in Indiana with an Indiana filmmaker, Joshua Hall. And I got brought in to be the lead in it, and it was super fun. And Josh and I hit it off right away. And we had so much fun on set and during, you know, the filmmaking process and, you know, being on set and all that. And then, you know, there was a few, one of the last few nights that we were filming there, Josh and I happened to be talking a lot about behind the camera stuff, you know, like what scenes to fix or jump here, or jump there, like setting up cameras. And I kind of fell in love with that process. And so after Chopping Block wrapped, Josh and I started talking about what we wanted to do next. And we were like, well, we definitely want to work together again. And so we had this idea of this, you know, filthy little Christmas movie. Like, what if there's not really a lot out there? All the Christmas movies are usually like very Hallmarky, you know, like everybody falls in love kind of thing. And Josh and I were like, what if there was a film about real Christmas, about people that are, you know, hiding all these lies from their family like you do? You know, you come home and you talk about your new job promotion that you don't fucking have. You're hiding your pill addiction or your weed from your mom and, you know, this and that. And so it was really about this family that was falling apart as they were coming together for Christmas. And they were all hiding kind of their vices and lies, and then it just comes to a head. And so we started writing on that, and Josh was actually supposed to direct it, and I was just supposed to star in it. And literally a week before we were supposed to all go back to Indiana and start filming again, Josh got picked up to be on a panel for Comic-Con for another movie that he had done, a superhero movie. And so he was like, hey, I got to go do this panel thing. What are we going to do about the filming and this and that? And we talked about it. And he came to me finally and he said, I've talked to everybody else, because we're using a lot of the same people from Chopping Block. And he's like, I've talked to everybody on the crew, and they will stand behind you if you want to step up and direct. And I was like, holy shit. Okay. let's try that, I guess.
You're going to have to go get one of those chairs. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got thrown into the fire and just fell in love with it, man. Really loved working with the actors, really loved getting the emotions from them, the comedy from them. And I couldn't have done any without my ex. She was such a huge help with it. Cause I'm so like, I'm big picture guy, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm like, okay, this happens and this and then this. And she's really good at being like, okay, this, like the in between and organizing and time wise and all that. Like, she was a huge help for that.
Yeah.
It was pretty much just her and I kind of teaming up for that. And we shot it all in like one location, which really helped. And it was just so much fun. And like I said, I just really fell in love with the storytelling aspect and being behind the camera. That awesome. Then that led to a few years later shooting Smashing Pumpkins, which also was me behind the camera and working with a crew and directing everything and telling this story. And I just really fell in love with it.
So you got a lot more in you, I take it.
Yeah. I'm working on a project now. I'm trying to raise some money for a full feature. I'm trying to, once the play ends, I'd like to get behind the camera again. And I have a pretty fun story to tell that I can't wait.
Yeah, well, good, man. Good. That's where people that listen to this show will know a couple people that were involved in that film. Ryan Colley, I think, was he a camera person?
Yeah.
Is. And by the way, you were the personally responsible for him getting the job with Pat McAfee.
Dude, Colley is incredible. I fucking love him to death. He's one of the best dudes I know. He's great.
He's phenomenal and talented, obviously. And then Rich Reagans. A lot of people here know Rich Reagans from our Shed Bar. He was one of your actors. He played your gay uncle.
Rich knocked it out the park.
And so good.
Yeah, he was incredible. And two things. With Ryan Colley, he definitely had a job on set one day that was just rolling fake joints. That was he definitely spent 3 hours rolling fake joints. And my ex fiance's father came on set because we were using their house. We had their house for 4.5 days. We were filming it.
Uh-huh.
So he stopped by the house on the afternoon. Ryan just has a table full of fake weed and rolling paper, and he's got like 12 joints rolled. That was great. And, that's what you want to see when you allow people to, you know, have your house for a few days. You come in, there's just
some dude outside on a table rolling joints. Oh my god, it's hilarious.
Secondly, one of my best memories from Bethlehem was with Rich Reagans, and working with him in that scene where he has the breakdown. The mom is hiding her pill addiction,
mm-hmm.
and Rich plays her brother, and he finds an empty pill container in one of the cabinets when they're cooking, and he has this moment where he starts searching through all the cabinets, and he's throwing all these pill bottles around the kitchen that he's finding hidden in these cabinets, some of them empty, some of them not. And he's having this really emotional breakdown about her addiction. And we had filmed it a couple times, you know, and it was okay. And then finally the last time he came to me and he's like, is there anything different? And we talked about it. And I said, I really need you just go crazy. Just really let it go. And he did. And it was night and day. He turned it up to 1,000, and he was like ripping through these cabinets and he's yelling at her, and they're the whole set is just tense. And I yell cut and nobody even moves. We're all just standing around. It was just so powerful. And Rich comes running over to me afterwards and he's just fucking crying, and he just gives me a hug, and he was like, thank you for letting me do that. And we talked about it, and apparently like addiction had run in his family and he had dealt with this in his real life, and he was able to pull from that to be on screen. And it was just like this beautiful fucking powerful moment that we got to capture, and I felt really, really lucky for having Rich involved in that. And I'm trying to get Rich involved in the other project that I'm working on.
There you go. Well, that scene, it was very powerful. I mean, I remember I was like, holy shit, Rich Reagan's like, huh. I mean, I was taken aback because, you know, we know each other as stand-up comedians. We're always fucking around. And then I saw that. I was like, whoa, good for you, buddy. It was real. It was a real moment. It was powerful and all that stuff. You felt everything you just said, I felt watching it. And so I don't know where, maybe he had encountered that in his real life and he pulled from it. But wow, you help him get it out, though. I see why. Like, what a moment when that must be, when this is your baby and you're like, and it's your money, and it's all, you're like, oh, you know, what is going to happen with this thing? And to see it come together and be so happy with the end product. I mean, how did you feel?
Oh, it was incredible. And it was more shocking than anything else. Because again, like what differs from stand up and film is that instant gratification, right? Because when you're doing well on stage, you know it. Yeah. You know, it's happening in the moment. And when you're not doing well, you really fucking know it.
Right.
but with film or sketch or even with the book, like you just kind of put it out there and you're like, well, I hope this is okay. And you don't really hear much feedback unless somebody DMs you or you hear this and that. And with Bethlehem, the shocking thing was we were entering it in all these film festival circuits, right? And just kind of like on a whim, just being like, all right, well, let's just see if we have something. And we got so lucky. We brought home 16 nominations and awards for that film. And it was, you know, best dark comedy, best ensemble cast, you know, all kinds of stuff that were coming in. And the reviews for it were just glowing, comparing it to the writing of the original Roseanne show and John Hughes films and this and that. And that to me was it, you know, I was chasing that high, you know, as the performer high you get from that instant gratification. Now I was chasing these reviews and these, you know, this feedback. You find yourself just hitting refresh all the time. Is there anything else? Did somebody like it on Amazon? Have they looked at it? It was so weird, but it also felt, because it was so personal and, you know, I write everything in that way where it's like a little roller coaster we go on, right? So we're having fun. And then, oh shit, you're feeling something. And then, oh, we're having fun. Before you can really even know what's going on or really feel bad about it, we're having fun again. And then we get real and then we're having fun. And so to have the response that we had from that be so glowing and be so great, it gave me the confidence to be like, okay, well, now I know that I can, that this formula works, and now I can apply it for other things. And that's kind of how I was doing with Laugh After Death when I was developing that special. It was like, you know, that ending piece, that last 20 minutes is all like, we're having fun, shit gets real. And we're having fun, and I'm making you feel something. Now we're having fun. So that's kind of just been my friend. The book is the same way. The stories, you're feeling something, and then the jokes, we're having fun. And then it's just, so that's kind of been this template that I've built that I didn't know that I was doing until these other projects have come along.
Do you find that what all three of your careers have in common is it's storytelling?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it has to do with the way I grew up, with being with my, you know, raised by my mother and my grandmother and all through, you know, pretty much high school and this and that. Like I was running in circles with women, you know, mm-hmm. and I, in life, in my romantic life, I'm really attracted to really strong, you know, character driven women. And I think it stems from that, because storytelling doesn't come from dudes. When you're hanging out with dudes, it's just like, oh, I went to the store. There was a chick with a fat ass and I got a Gatorade. You're like, all right. You ask a woman the same story. She's like, I pulled up and this Nissan Sonata came up to me. Gold colored, I think, like that necklace I bought one time when I was feeling not quite like myself, but I really wasn't sick. And remember, I went to the doctor and he had told me about that new prescription jug that we thought was going to kill Stace, and you're like, what the fuck? And so I think I've learned that storytelling or how to conversate with people just being brought up in that world of, mm-hmm. of details and you know, extending that conversation.
Sure. So that shaped what kind of storyteller you are, which is, you're right. That, I mean, from that perspective, there's many layers to the telling of the story, which obviously makes it more entertaining to listen to. But is that what attracts you about each of those mediums that you're working in? Is I get to just simply tell stories, my own or someone else's, but each one in a different fashion? I mean, is that?
Yeah, I think.
I'm only asking because I'm trying to relate it to myself. I'm trying to figure myself out right now. I know that I love stand up and I know that I love podcasting, and yeah. I enjoy like this kind of like helping other people tell their own personal stories and getting the listeners a chance to get to know them as real people. Like I like that. And then I love document. Like if right now, if I could win the lottery, how would I keep myself busy? I would only make documentaries, just constantly. I'd be always working on documentaries. So for me personally, I'm wanting to say I enjoy telling and sharing stories, but I can't just be satisfied being stuck in one discipline, I guess.
Yeah. And I think the theme that I'm just thinking about now is, you know, I do want to help others, and the main theme that I, you know, as generic as it is it, you know, the theme is it's okay to not be okay. And I think if you look back through Bethlehem, you'll find that theme there, that it's okay not to be okay. You know, all you have this family, this dysfunctional family that's all hiding something from the other one because they're scared of the judgment. I think we all feel that way when we go home for the holidays. And Smashing Pumpkins is the same thing. You have these two old friends that are pretending to be more successful or more this or more that, and, you know, not allowing their guard to be let down. You know, not admitting that things aren't as perfect as they thought they were going to be. Same thing with Laugh After Death and Dead Serious. Those are all, you know, all these projects are saying the same thing, that we're all kind of fucking broken, and that's okay because we're all fucking broken. But we're all pretending to not be. And I think my message is that that I try to relate is that that's okay, and yeah. And that you're okay.
Wow. Okay. So that's a bit of a motivator. I mean, what a message, first of all, because there's none of us that aren't broken in some way. It's just a matter of, you know, how well you carry around those broken pieces.
What you do with those broken pieces. And that's, you know, I talk a little bit about it in the book about choosing the weight that we carry with us, right? Because when you lose somebody or something bad happens to you, or, you know, fill in the blank there, you have to learn how to let go of some of that, or else you're not going to grow. You're not going to go any further. You're not going to progress. You're going to fucking drown out there because you're allowing all of this stuff to weigh you down. And so we have to kind of choose what to take with us and what to let go. And for me, you know, like there's a lot of sadness that happens with, you know, after my mother passed, of course, there's a lot of weight that weighs on you. But I've been slowly over the years taking some of that weight off and choosing what to take with me. You know, like for instance, like her voice. I never want to forget her voice. And so I'll carry that with me. But I'm going to let go some of the anger and resentment I have to myself or with myself that I couldn't be there all the time for her, that I couldn't, you know, looking back, I really didn't step up enough after Wayne passed, or I should have done this, I should have done that. You got to let go of some of that because that's the shit that's going to fucking kill you. So carry with you her voice, the good times, some of the stuff we've done, you know, the memories, that kind of stuff, and let go of that resentment and that anger and all of that shit, because all that shit will fucking drown you. and you can't let that happen.
I couldn't agree more, because in those instances, you're trying to measure yourself against a better make-believe version of yourself. And that's not possible. You know, if you want to measure yourself just simplistically by, was I a good son? Or was I a shitty son? You know, it's okay to be a good son and not be perfect, because no one is. And I obviously you were that. You had a great relationship with both your parents, and especially your mother, I know. So when you are knocking out these creative projects now, all of which you should personally be very proud of, how do you think your mom looking down, is she like, yep, That's exactly what I expected. This is Michael.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think she knew that I was a workhorse. And I think, you know, one of the things that she did notice that about me was that I was very driven. And I think that she wouldn't be surprised at all to see what I've done with these broken pieces. I think she'd be very happy. And I think that she would love that I'm trying to help other people, you know, because yeah. She helped other people. There was, you know, when you go and clean out somebody's house after they passed, you find all these things, these little hidden gems every once in a while. I joke about it on stage about when Wayne passed, I went through his computer and all that stuff. And the only thing I found was just the word titties in all capital letters. That was, that was the only thing was the only bad thing he said. So big titties is what he was after. And, but you know, I was going through my mom's stuff as you do, cause you're trying to figure out what bills are paid and what accounts are there and this, and you're closing different accounts and this and that. And I was going through her messages on Facebook, and there were so many people that she was helping in the community that I had no idea that she was helping. She was lending people $20 here and there. She'd give food to a few people. She would talk, like, there were some messages from friends of mine that were comedians or girlfriends of comedians or wives or whatever. And she was messaging them when they had a bad day. And she was talking to them about their son or their daughter, or about, you know, a problem they had at school or something. And she was giving them advice, or she was, you know, doing this or that. And I didn't even know that was happening. My mother had this whole other, you know, community service that I didn't even know about. And wow. So bringing it around full circle, I think that she would be happy that I'm trying to help other people and spreading the message that it's okay and that you're okay.
Absolutely. Well, let's help yourself a little bit. You landed a role on one of the coolest shows ever done in stand-up comedy, in my opinion. I'm Dying Up Here.
Oh man, that was great.
Showtime, right? How did that come to be?
I was actually, you know, I'm good friends with Brad Garrett, and he obviously stars in the second season of that. He fucking steals the show, by the way.
He does.
He's incredible in that second season. And, you know, I play his club there in Vegas, and we've known each other for a long time. And I was talking to him about this and that, and he had reached out and he had said that there was an opening. And so I applied and, you know, sent over my reel and all of that stuff. And he told me, you know, because he told me, oh, I'm working on Fargo and I'm working on this other show and this and that. which Fargo was fantastic as well.
Yes.
And so he said, hey, there's an opening over here on the Showtime show that I'm doing. And it's for a club MC, and it's supposed to be in this club in Pasadena. And he's like, you should submit and all this stuff. And so I submitted my reel and all that. And then they got back to me right away, and they were like, yeah, you're in. We looked at your reel. This is perfect. Like, you know, I had already done a couple things for Comedy Central and Fox at that point, and you know, the films under my belt and stuff like that. And so they were like, yeah, good to go. And that was such an incredible experience. And they actually added that scene, that last scene with Brad and I, that closes out the episode. They actually added that later after bringing me on.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, this wasn't like just, you know, sometimes you see comedians get to pop in and they're like passing somebody in the hallway. Hey, buddy. And, you know, that's it.
Right.
I mean, you had there was a moment on stage, you had interaction with, like, it was a significant role in that episode.
Like, it's so funny too. Here's a little behind the scenes magic for you. So it's my first time on a set of that scale, right? Like, I had done stuff for Comedy Central, but it was a closed set kind of thing. And this had, I mean, it took place in a comedy club, right? So there's 100 extras sitting around. There's the whole camera crew. Then you have Brad and Michael and you know, the main cast is all there. So you have 200 people around. And so it's a pretty big set. And it's Showtime and all this other shit. And so I'm sitting there. I'm waiting for in between takes. And Michael, the lead on the show, he's up there doing his big monologue, his big like kind of meltdown, right?
Right.
And the first few times he does it, it's incredible. Like, it's so powerful to watch. And I'm sitting off to the back of the stage, and because I'm supposed to run out and grab him when he goes after the guy. He gets in a fight with a heckler. And so I'm supposed to run out and grab and kind of wrestle with him. And so I have to pee so fucking bad. So they're like, all right, let's take it again from the top, you know? And so that means that Michael's going to run his full monologue, right? And with Brad yelling from the audience, the whole deal. So I'm like, this is the perfect time. I'm going to go piss. By the time I get back, we'll wrestle. It'll be great. So I don't tell anybody, and I leave set, and I go piss, and I come back. And he's in the middle of the fight with the heckler. Oh. And I'm like, oh shit. And I can tell that they're waiting for me to like come grab him. So I come running from the back of the room and get on stage and wrestle with him. And he fucking throws me down. And that's the take that they use. If you watch this, if you watch the episode, you see me run from the back of the room. And I'm not supposed to be doing that. I'm supposed to be right there behind the curtains.
But it looked better. Then, you were really panicked in real life.
Yeah, I was really fucking like, oh shit.
I'm going to get fired.
So I ran up and in that scene, I'm not like, I'm just supposed to kind of like grab him and kind of move him around. But Michael had done this monologue like 4 or 5 times by this point. So he was like really in the moment. And I come running around and I'm grabbing him and he's fighting me off. And we kind of really go at it for a second. And he legit throws me to the ground. And I just rolled with it, you know. And that's the actual take that they ended up using in the episode of just me getting tossed like a sack of potatoes in a full panic.
Oh, what a cool experience, man. And it was a, you know, I love like period pieces, you know, in TV series that are set in a certain era. And it was just in that golden era of comedy.
Oh, the clothes were incredible.
Yeah, you were in a full
thing and.
You were in like a full denim outfit, weren't you? Like,
yeah, and they gave me hair. They gave me hair down past my shoulders. It's so funny too, because people that don't work in TV think that's like my fucking hair. So I have people commenting. I had people when I put the photos up and the screen grabs on my social media, I had people commenting all the time, like, your hair was so long. Like, you should keep it that way. Like, bitch, I had this hair for 5 hours. That's so great.
That is,
you know,
so
what? I will say this. Brad is such a giving and generous person. He's like one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my entire life. And during a filming of that, we were riding over to the set and they take you over in like this little van, right? And we're all sitting in the van talking about stuff. And I'm telling Brad, I go, there's a great donut shop about 3 blocks from here called Kettle Glazed. I go, if you guys are filming here a bunch, because they were filming in that area, we did the table read a couple blocks over. And so I knew that Brad had been there a bunch. And I was like, next time you're in this area, you should check out Kettle Glazed. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll check it out. You know, blah, blah, blah. We're sitting there bullshitting back and forth. So we go and do our little check-in, and then they take us back to the set. And by the time we got back to our little trailers, this person comes walking on set and has 6 full boxes of Kettle Glazed donuts, and they bring it to my trailer, and they knock on my door, and I'm like, what is this? And they're like, Brad said that you had said this place had great donuts, so you get first pick, but he bought donuts for the whole crew. And so... Brad, just by mentioning like, oh, this place has nice donuts, he went and bought donuts for like 200 fucking people just as a, hey, I heard this place is great kind of thing. He's beyond the nicest guy in the world.
It's so great, dude. Yeah, I'm so happy to see you get that, because I personally liked that show a lot. I was like, oh, this is a great really show. Good show. And then when you popped up in there, I was like, oh, yeah. So it's really cool, man. It's really cool to watch everything you do. I know we're not in touch a lot just because, you know, California is far from Indianapolis and we're both busy, hardworking people. But let's stay in touch more so than we have, because as we both know, shit happens. And you know, and afterward, be like, I wish I'd have called him once, twice more than I did. Yeah. And anytime, of course, that you pass through or you're doing anything in the area and you need to reach out to some folks and let them know what you're doing, please let me know. And you always have a place to crash here, too, if you ever need it. I got an extra bedroom. Not all of them are converted into podcast studios. So.
Just most of them. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I want to remind people that you and Ryan M. Brewer, who was on a couple episodes ago, have a podcast together called Speakerphone.
Yeah, we started doing these great conversations. Brewer and I, we've known each other for years. And one of the things is like, we would hop on the phone and we'd be on the phone for an hour, hour and a half. And we'd have these incredible conversations about politics or just bullshitting or this and that, you know, just life. And every time we got off the phone, we would, you know, kind of message each other like, man, I wish somebody would have heard that. And so eventually we're just like, what if that's just the podcast? And so we've kind of made it so you're just kind of listening in to the two of us kind of talk about, you know, life, the universe, politics, this or that, like whatever's going on. And it's been super fun. And I fucking love Brewer to death. And
yeah, well, you're both great conversationalists, obviously, both very talented in your own right, in your own mediums, and both smart dudes, which I think is important. That's what I lack in my podcast game, Michael. I'm just not a real smart dude, you know?
So. Yeah, Brewer's way smarter than me.
Yeah.
I hate him for it, you know?
Well, and anybody that can play music like that has a, you know, right, fuck, yeah. Fuck you. Yeah, fuck on. You.
Right.
Your life's too easy with women. All right, buddy. This has been a lot of fun, man. I really enjoyed sitting to chat with you, and I look forward to looking at everything that you put out here in the near future because I know it's great. I still need to watch Smashing Pumpkins, so I'm looking forward to that because I've probably seen Bethlehem 8 or 10 times. So
that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get messages from people around, you know, around Christmas every year. And it's saying that, you know, that it's made it its way into their rotation of holiday films and stuff, which is just, again, like insane to think about.
It's a dark, charming movie. It's fun. You know what I mean? It's fun. Yeah. It's dark, but it's fun. And everybody can see a little bit of themselves in it. And I think, you know, that's what makes it work. It's relatable.
The brother character is my favorite character. Mike Wolf just knocks it out of the park. He's just so fun to watch, and you can't have him on screen for more than 10 seconds and I'm just fucking dying laughing. He's so good.
Yeah, he's great. And Derek Zhu did a great job in it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, so many great people.
Derek Zhu knocked it out. You know what? Here's a little, before we head off here, there's a little behind the scenes Bethlehem. The actor that was supposed to play Cousin Brian missed his flight that morning and could not come in. And Derek had been on set helping out. And he, you know, he has years of vaudeville acting and comedy and all this stuff behind him. And he literally got the script that day and was fitted and had makeup that afternoon and was on camera that evening as Cousin Brian.
Wow. And he did a great job. Good for him.
And he crushed it.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, everybody that's listening, please follow Michael Malone on all social media. Is it at Malone Comedy on all of them?
Or? Yep. Everything's at Malone Comedy. Super easy. And I'm actually doing a thing right now with my book. You can go to MaloneComedy.com, and I'm raising money for a couple mental health organizations because suicide rates have just skyrocketed since the pandemic and everything else. And they're a little overwhelmed. So I'm donating proceeds from my book to a couple mental health organizations, the Trevor Project, and another one. And so if you go to MaloneComedy.com, you can get a signed copy, you get a bookmarker, you get stickers, and you get a free digital copy of the book for your iPad or Kindle. And the proceeds will go towards mental health.
Oh, nice, man. That's great. Well, everybody go there. If you forgot anything about what we just said, go to the episode description because I'll put links to all things Michael Malone in there for you to make it easy. And if you didn't know Michael before, you do now. So stick with him. He has a very, very awesome career ahead of him. He's still a young man. You're only like 50 now, 51?
Yeah, well, no, that's me. 51 You're, this spring. 51.
Yeah. No, he's still a young man, and he's one of the most talented guys I know. So you better get on the train now before, you know, everybody's on the train and he's super famous, and then it's not as cool.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, brother. Thanks for hanging out.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.